Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The dust had enveloped everything, blocking out the boiling rays of the August sun. The pounding of thousands of feet and hooves had churned it into a fine mist that swirled through the air, blowing and roiling and twisting. Great tufts of white smoke, blasting forth from the barrels of arquebuses and cannon, melded with the dust and created eddies of choking haze. But here and there, the clouds parted. The dust settled just long enough to allow a glimpse of what lay inside. The sun shone through, reflecting off thousands upon thousands of helmets, shields, armor plates, horse harnesses, bronze cannon, and gun barrels. A pair of keen, interested eyes watched the battle unfold. They sat above a prominent nose and a thick black mustache that split a tanned, harsh, unforgiving face. Selim, ruler of the Ottoman Empire, known to later generations as the Grim, observed the proceedings with satisfaction. He registered the twanging of bowstrings and the crackle of arquebuses, saw flashes of the conical white caps of his janissaries, his personal slave soldiers. Amid the clouds of dust, watched the charging Mamluks on armored horses felled by the blasts of cannon and gunfire. War cries in Arabic, Turkic, Kurdish, Slavic, Greek, Circassian, and half a dozen other languages split the air, competing for space with the howls of the wounded and the screams of dying horses. This was the end, Selim knew, the end of the Mamluks. For more than two centuries, the Mamluks had ruled Egypt, the Levant, and Syria, and stood as guardians of the holiest places in Islam. Now, the tide was turning. Selim's janissaries and cannon were ending their reign, spraying this Syrian field with blood, and the Ottomans would stand supreme atop the Islamic world. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. At its peak, the Ottoman Empire spanned three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe, and two worlds, the Christian and the Islamic. In large part, it was the bridge between those two worlds, stretching from the Persian Gulf and the Iranian Plateau in the east to Algiers on the coast of North Africa in the west. In the north, the plains of Hungary and the open steppe of the Crimean Peninsula fell under its sway, while in the south, it touched the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, and Islam's holiest cities, Mecca and Medina. In the popular imagination, the Ottomans are often treated as the exotic other, a reflection of that distant, foreign Islamic world. That vision of secluded harems and strange, decadent customs is mostly a product of the 18th and 19th centuries, the era of Ottoman decline in the face of relentless European expansion. The reality was far different. The Ottomans were a fundamentally European power from the very beginning. The empire's original capital was in Edirne, northwest of Constantinople, long before they conquered the great city. Throughout the 15th century, they expanded into the Balkans, not the Eurasian steppe or even Syria. Mehmed the Conqueror, who took Constantinople, spent far more of his time making war on Venetians and Hungarians than the Turkomans of Anatolia and Persia. For most of that early period of Ottoman history, what we've covered on Tides thus far, the Ottomans were oriented far more toward the west than toward the east. They were essentially the northwesternmost outpost of that vast, sophisticated, and wealthy Islamic world. This fits with what we've discussed. The Ottoman Empire was fundamentally a frontier state that had expanded into what had been Christian territory. As Mehmed the Conqueror embarked on his last campaign in 1481, the final one of a long, bloody, and impactful reign, his empire ruled far more Christians than Muslims. Its central state institution, the Sultan's household, was largely recruited from among the empire's Christian population. So were the janissaries, the professional infantry who provided the backbone of the empire's military might. There was little pressure for Ottoman subjects to convert. Well, some did. Byzantine and Venetian tax systems survived mostly unchanged in formerly Christian territories. Christian princes paid tribute to the Sultan and ruled Christian populations as part of the empire, though there were fewer of them than there had been earlier. Yet the Ottomans were never isolated from the rest of the Islamic world. Their early competitors were the small Turkoman Beyliks of Anatolia. They borrowed Persian-style bureaucratic practices to run their state from their Islamic neighbors, namely the Seljuk Turks and the Ilkhans of Persia. Their expansion was largely driven by the potent combination of holy war and material gain, which helped them appeal to the Muslim Turkoman tribesmen of Anatolia, many of them newly arrived from the Eurasian steppe. This was the key to fueling the early Ottoman conquests, and lots of the Turkomans ended up migrating to the European territories. Being Islamic rulers was always a key part of Ottoman identity, and became increasingly important as time went on. The Ottoman sultans occasionally clashed with the other polities of the Muslim world. Sultan Bayezid I clashed with the last great steppe warlord, Tamerlane, whose territories stretched from China to Anatolia. Bayezid died as Tamerlane's prisoner after the disastrous Battle of Ankara in 1402, setting off a decade of devastating Ottoman civil wars. In the later years of Mehmet the Conqueror's reign, he made war on the Akoyunlu of the Iranian plateau, his rivals for domination in eastern Anatolia. Frictions with the Mamluks, the rulers of Egypt, the Levant, and Syria, increased during Mehmet's reign as well. By the time Mehmet died in 1481, it was clear that the Ottoman focus increasingly needed to turn east, toward their Muslim neighbors. That's what we'll focus on here today. How the Ottomans interacted with, and then eventually conquered, huge swaths of the Islamic world, specifically the regions formerly controlled by the Mamluks of Egypt. Between 1481 and 1520, the Ottoman sultans went from being frontier rulers on the fringes of that Islamic world to the guardians of its holiest places, its linchpins and most important figures. Before we get to that, though, let's take a moment to try to understand what the Islamic world looked like in 1481. This has been a Europe-focused show, mostly because that's where I'm most comfortable, and it's where my specialties lie. But it's time for us to expand our horizons. For those of us comfortable with a medieval European perspective, the scope of the Islamic world in this period is daunting and dazzling. By comparison, Christendom looks small, provincial, impoverished. This is worth highlighting and repeating, because it's the baseline state of affairs that explains why Europeans were the ones getting on rickety ships to take dangerous voyages into the Atlantic in the 15th century. Muslim merchants already had access to those valuable goods and lucrative routes. When Da Gama showed up on the coast of India in 1498, for example, he encountered traders from the western reaches of North Africa. Even so far from home, those Muslim merchants weren't at all out of place. The Portuguese were the foreigners, not them. Thanks to their religion, the Arabic language, and some broadly shared cultural, political, and legal characteristics, people could and did move easily over the vast distances that separated the various corners of the Islamic world. And those distances really were vast. Muslims populated the Atlantic coast of Morocco, and Muslim emperors ruled the West African states of Mali and Songhai. Muslim sultans dominated the east coast of Africa with its lucrative trade in gold and slaves. The entirety of the Indian Ocean trade, from Mozambique and Kilwa to the Spice Islands of Southeast Asia, was controlled by Muslim merchants. The ubiquitous dhows, the trading ships that crisscrossed the sea lanes from the Malay Peninsula to India to the Persian Gulf to Arabia, carried luxury goods, people, ideas, and of course, Islam. The Emirate of Granada was the last toehold in Spain, the final remnant of a once great center of Islamic civilization. But it faced a North African coast that was almost entirely Muslim from the Straits of Gibraltar to Egypt. The Mamluk sultans, descendants of imported slave soldiers, ruled the Nile and its environs. Mamluk territory stretched into the Near East, the Levant and Syria, along with the holy cities of Arabia. Various groups of Turkomans, Turkic-speaking migrants from the Great Eurasian Steppe, ruled most of what's now Iraq, Iran, Georgia, Armenia, and Iran, melding Persian culture and political structures with warrior traditions from the steppe. The Great Eurasian Steppe, too, was mostly Muslim, everywhere from the Ukraine to the edges of Mongolia. The Silk Road and the great trading cities of Central Asia, like Bukhara and Samarkand, were all outposts in the Muslim world as well. From there, the Muslim world reached southward through the Hindu Kush to the plain of the Ganges and the Deccan Plateau in India. a long way separated the beautifully decorated halls of the Alhambra in Granada from the yurt of a nomadic Turkish warlord in the rolling grasslands of Central Asia or the pitching deck of a dhow off the coast of the Malay Peninsula. But they were all part of that broader tradition, connected to one another in a myriad of ways. Cultural, political, legal, economic, and above all, religious. A legal scholar trained in a school in Tangiers, Morocco, could find work in Delhi, as the great traveler Ibn Battuta tried to do in the middle of the 14th century. Turkic nomads born near the Caspian Sea were enslaved, sold, and then transported to Egypt, where they fought as elite military slaves. A poet born in Samarkand could find an audience for his Persian language compositions in Istanbul. Merchants from Algiers acquired gold and slaves in Mali and Songhai, far across the sands and rocks of the Sahara. This was a vast, complex, and dynamic world, never united, constantly shifting, full of competing states and varied ideas about law, faith, and society. The Ottoman Empire had begun on the fringes of this world, and that marginal position is essential to remember when we try to understand how and why it developed the way it did. On the one hand, the Ottomans were unique among their Islamic peers. They mostly ruled Christian subjects. Their great rivals were European Christians, and they inherited a variety of Latin and Byzantine traditions from their predecessors in Anatolia and the Balkans. Their proximity to raidable, conquerable Christian-held lands was one major explanation for their early success, along with their facility at building institutions and structures that could stand the test of time. But on the other hand, the Ottomans benefited from and participated in many of the broader trends of the Islamic world. The Persianate bureaucratic and cultural traditions, concepts of holy war, called Gaza, jurisprudence and law, ideals of religious orthodoxy and heterodoxy, political concepts and structures, and of course the slave-based ruler's household and military slavery in the form of the Janissaries. Those connections grew stronger over time, just as the Ottomans did, as they looked for models of rulership, political ideas, legal structures, and religious legitimacy. The Ottomans found all of that in the long and powerful traditions of the Islamic world. So in early May of 1481, as Mehmet the Conqueror's bloated, ravaged corpse began to decompose, his suddenly leaderless empire faced both east and west. In the west, the brief invasion of southern Italy had come to an end, but there was no way for the terrified inhabitants of the peninsula to be sure of that. The 16-year-long war with Venice was over, but there were still plenty of points of friction where the Venetian overseas empire rubbed up against Ottoman territory. Across the Danube, the aggressive king of Hungary, Matthias Corvinus, ruled an expansive and expanding kingdom that was constantly clashing with its Polish and Austrian neighbors. But the real action over the next several decades would happen to the east, in the Islamic world. Mehmet had spent several years battling the Akoyunlu, the white sheep Turkomans, a tribal confederation that ruled most of what's now Iran, Iraq, Azerbaijan, and Armenia, extending into eastern Anatolia and present-day Turkey. With the death of their great ruler, Uzun Hasan, instability had set into the east. This presented both an opportunity and a challenge to a rudderless Ottoman Empire. To make matters more complicated, the religious sentiments of many of the Turkomans who lived in this large frontier belt were growing more extreme, more influenced by the Twelver Shiite sympathies of the Safavid order, who were becoming an increasingly important political and religious force. To the southeast, in Syria, the Mamluk sultans based in Egypt still held sway, as they had for centuries. Their lands extended from the Taurus Mountains near the Mediterranean coast of Anatolia all the way to the Red Sea, including the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. The Mamluks were lurking, and it was only a matter of time until an inevitable conflict erupted with the ascendant Ottomans. This was a tripolar alignment of powers, and the balance could only stand for so long.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The moment of a sultan's death was always the time of greatest risk and instability for the Ottoman Empire. A ruling sultan generally had several sons. While he might have a favorite or one he considered most suitable to follow him onto the throne, that was no guarantee of succession. Only one could rule, a principle called unigeniture. The potential claimants were virtually guaranteed to fight it out. Sometimes this was a quick, brutal, and relatively painless process. In the aftermath of their father's death on the battlefield of Kosovo in 1389, Bayezid I called his brother Yakub to his tent and had him strangled, thereby securing the succession. But more often, civil war was the result. There were deep structural tensions baked into the Ottoman system. Between the sultan's household center and the quasi-independent frontier lords on the periphery, between those of Turkic descent and the converted Christians, usually from the Balkans, between the often discontented Janissaries and their master, between stabilizing institutions and the individual hunger for power, between strict religious orthodoxy and the kind of permissive Sufi heterodoxy that flourished in the out-of-the-way spaces of the empire, and of course between the ever-expanding Ottoman state and its fearful, opportunistic neighbors. All of these tensions exploded at the moment a sultan died. Each of the sultan's surviving sons, assuming he had survived to this point, knew that he would need supporters to win the inevitable civil war. That meant cultivating the loyalty of the frontier lords, the provincial governors, the aga of the Janissaries, the viziers of the palace, even foreign rulers and power brokers. Each of these power bases cultivated a potential heir in turn, placing their bets on a combination of pliancy and competence. Obviously, this was a dangerous game for everyone involved. Sultans didn't come to the throne or stay there by allowing dangerous plots among their underlings, especially among their potential successors. More than one promising young Ottoman prince, perhaps thinking that his time to rule should come sooner rather than later, met his end on his father's orders. Household officials or regional governors or Janissary commanders caught conspiring met the executioner in large numbers. Now, this was all part of the Ottoman system. These structural tensions played themselves out through the medium of succession and civil war, aligning themselves with the potential claimants to the throne. So, when Mehmet died in early May of 1481, his death set off precisely this type of mad scramble for power. He left behind two sons, Bayezid and Cem. In fact, the most likely cause of Mehmet's death was poisoning, and the most likely culprit behind the act was Bayezid. It can never be proven, of course, but Bayezid had clashed with his father before, and he stood to gain the most from his death. Just before his death, in April of 1481, Mehmet had apparently decided, or been persuaded, by his Grand Vizier Mehmet Pasha, that it was time to do away with Bayezid and elevate Cem as his successor. This gave Bayezid all the incentive in the world to act, and either his own agency, luck, or divine intervention would give him the outcome that he wanted. Bayezid and Mehmet were very different people. This goes a long way toward explaining their seemingly instinctive dislike of each other, and why Mehmet didn't want Bayezid to succeed him as ruler. While Mehmet lived for conquest and spent practically his whole life on campaign, Bayezid disliked war. He wasn't inexperienced in military matters. He was far from incompetent. But Bayezid was never obsessed by war in the same way Mehmet had been. Their differences ran deeper, too. Mehmet, for all his war-making against Christians, had been very much a free thinker and with great interest in and tolerance for alternative religious worldviews. He collected Christian relics and spent many hours in debate and discussions with poets and scholars of all backgrounds. This is a facet of his personality that has always contrasted with his readiness to employ the most extreme violence against those he considered his enemies. Bayezid, by contrast, was deeply religious, a patron of Sufi brotherhoods and mystic dervishes, precisely the kinds of holy men his father had held in contempt. By nature, Bayezid was a stabilizer, where his father had been a disruptor of established traditions and socio-political structures. Power had been Mehmet's ultimate goal, power concentrated in his hands alone and available to use for his purposes. Conquest and everlasting glory were his overriding goals. Naturally, this created conflicts within the Ottoman Empire, deep ones and enemies. Those enemies looked for a supporter, and they found one in the 33-year-old Bayezid. When I mentioned that structural tensions played themselves out through the succession, this is what I meant. The frontier warlords, sidelined by Mehmet's increasingly powerful centralized state, backed Bayezid. So did the Sufi brotherhoods and the traditional religious authorities. The Janissaries, sick and tired of war after more than three decades of constant, brutal campaigning everywhere from eastern Anatolia to southern Italy, were willing to back someone who promised a respite. Arranged against Bayezid and these backers was Cem Sultan, Mehmet's younger brother, 21 years old and 12 years his brother's junior. He had the support of the Grand Vizier, Mehmet Pasha. Events unfolded quickly in the aftermath of the Sultan's death. The Grand Vizier, Mehmet Pasha, dispatched letters to Cem, urging him to hurry to Istanbul to claim the throne before Bayezid could arrive, but the messengers were intercepted. Mehmet Pasha arrived in the capital, but so did the Janissaries, who soon ran wild when they learned that Mehmet was dead. Backing Bayezid and not being especially fond of the Grand Vizier, the Janissaries captured him, cut off his head, and paraded through the streets of Istanbul with their trophy impaled on the point of a spear. Cem was immediately deprived of his most important ally in the struggle against Bayezid. Still, Cem made his play, first offering to divide the empire between him and Bayezid, and then entering open conflict. Neither option proved successful. Bayezid defeated his brother, and Cem was forced to flee. But where was an Ottoman prince on the losing side of a civil war to go? With the Akayunlu of Persia mired in succession disputes and internal conflicts of their own, there was only one real option. The Mamluk sultans of Egypt, whose territory extended from the Red Sea and the Nile up to the edges of Ottoman territory in Anatolia. Tensions between the Mamluks and the Ottomans had been rising for a generation. Mehmet and the Mamluk sultan, Kait Bey, had clashed over who would wield influence in the Anatolian border states, Beyliks, of Karaman and Dulgadir, basically what's now southeastern Turkey. In addition to their material disputes, Mehmet and Kait Bey exchanged diplomatic insults. An Ottoman envoy refused to kiss the ground in front of the Mamluk sultan, and a letter called Kait Bey my brother instead of my father, a grievous breach of protocol. Kait Bey retaliated by sending a minor flunky to Mehmet to negotiate instead of a powerful official. These were small things, really, but indicative of a much larger conflict on the horizon. The Mamluks sat at the center of the Islamic world, and it was only a matter of time before they and the Ottomans clashed in a major way. So Cem fled to the safety that Kait Bey offered. In fairness, the Ottomans had sheltered renegade Mamluk officials, too, but maintaining a renegade prince was on an entirely different level. "You are my son, do not be sad," Kait Bey told Cem, and he allowed Cem to go on the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. This was an enormous blow to Bayezid, a nightmare scenario for any Ottoman ruler. His powerful neighbor had a massive lever with which to prod him. Whenever Bayezid overstepped, Kait Bey could simply provide Cem with an army and unleash him into Ottoman territory, triggering the chaos and danger of a civil war between equally viable claimants to the Ottoman throne. That was exactly what happened in 1482. As Kait Bey saw it, this was a golden opportunity to regain some ground after the long, successful, and threatening reign of Mehmet the Conqueror. It was a chance to put the Ottomans back in their place. Kait Bey also had a claimant to the defunct Emirate of Karaman in his possession, and if he could be restored, then so too could a buffer state between the Mamluks and the Ottomans. When Cem asked Kait Bey for permission to make an attempt on the throne, the Mamluks offered money and assistance, though perhaps not as much as Chem had wanted, needed, or expected. The result was predictable. Chem was only able to gather a small army from the Turkomans of the frontier and some of the disaffected, angry Ottoman subjects in the Far East. Bayezid crushed his rebellion, and Chem fled, this time to the safety of the Hospitaller Knights on Rhodes. Kait Bey realized immediately that he should have kept Chem in his possession as a threat, a cudgel to wield against Bayezid. Chem really had far more potential than real value, and by supporting him against Bayezid, Kait Bey had turned an abstract great power rivalry that didn't have to happen into a blood feud. More conflict was the inevitable result. The Hospitallers were a crusading order, a thorn in the side of the Ottomans for decades. Their stronghold on Rhodes had resisted an Ottoman invasion in 1480, and they were longtime observers of the ins and outs of the empire's politics. No less than the Mamluks, they understood what an opportunity a renegade Ottoman prince represented. He was an insurance policy against another Ottoman invasion. He was potentially a revenue source. The Grand Master of the Hospitallers, a Frenchman named Pierre de Aubusson, welcomed Chem to Rhodes. Chem stayed in Christian hands from 1482 until his death in 1495, a constant bit of leverage preventing Bayezid from pursuing an aggressive foreign policy in the West, as his father, Mehmet the Conqueror, had done. But before we get any further, we need to talk a bit about the Mamluks. Who were they, and why were they so important? Well, to start with, Mamluk is simply a general term for a slave soldier. It was in use throughout the Islamic world, and over the centuries, there were many dynasties and ruling cliques that had their origins among slave soldiery. There was a Mamluk sultanate in Delhi, for example. But in this case, the best-known one, the Mamluks of Egypt, had originally come to power there more than two centuries prior to Bayezid's accession. The Mamluks of Egypt had gotten their start as a cadre of slave soldiers, imported in vast numbers from the steppe north of the Black Sea to Egypt, where they were converted to Islam, trained, and served as the elite soldiers of the Ayyubid dynasty. The Ayyubids were the descendants of Saladin, ultimately of Kurdish origin, and they ruled a state that stretched from Egypt to Syria. After 1250, though, the Mamluks deposed the Ayyubids and established a series of dynasties. One sultan, the famous Baibars, defeated the seemingly indestructible Mongols and expelled the last crusaders from the Holy Land. Others extended Mamluk domination throughout the Levant in Syria and took control of the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, making them the most prestigious rulers in the Muslim world. They controlled the incredibly lucrative luxury trade from the east, which passed through their ports in the Levant, the Red Sea, and Egypt, and which made the sultans of Cairo incredibly wealthy. A constant influx of new slave recruits from the steppe maintained the dynasty's military prowess and its deep roots. The Sultan Kait Bey was himself a Circassian from the North Caucasus Mountains, and he had arrived in Egypt when he was already more than 20 years old. But by the closing years of the 15th century, the Mamluks were not quite the power they'd been a century or two before. It was harder to acquire the essential supply of military slaves from the region north of the Black Sea, leaving them less militarily capable. Some still came, like Kait Bey, but fewer than in the Halcyon days. Tamerlane's genocidal invasion of Syria in the late 14th century had been devastating, and those regions had never really recovered. On top of that, repeated waves of plague had reduced the population. There was a little bit less trade with the East, which meant lower tax revenues. Currency debasement had disastrous consequences for the economy. At the same time, the implications of the rise of the Ottomans weren't lost on them. As long as the Ottomans had been a frontier state oriented toward holy war against Christians and conquest within Europe, things had been manageable. Why would an Ottoman sultan want to spend his time fighting the mobile, nomadic Turkmen of Anatolia or risk problems by fighting fellow Muslims when there were easier and more lucrative targets in the West? As the historian Shai Har-El points out, the Ottomans were a two-front state with a one-front army, an army mostly pointed at Europe. But the strategic calculus was shifting. The Ottomans were a world power after the conquest of Constantinople, not some minor frontier beylik. Mehmet the Conqueror had turned his attention to the east, clearly signaling that he was willing to fight co-religionists when necessary. The buffer state of Karaman in southeastern Anatolia was gone. The Akoyunlu of Iran were sliding downward in the aftermath of a series of defeats at Ottoman hands. Were the Mamluks next? This kind of calculation goes a long way toward explaining why Kait Bey took the risky step of supporting Chem, risking Bayezid's wrath. When Chem first went to Rhodes and then to a succession of European courts as an honored exile, Kait Bey tried to get him back. Bayezid found out, and open war was the inevitable result. Perhaps surprisingly, given the rising trajectory of the Ottomans and the downward swing of the Mamluks, the war that broke out in 1485 didn't go especially well for Bayezid. An army led by one of his sons-in-law suffered a disastrous defeat at Adana in southeast Turkey in 1486. The son-in-law was captured, and his vaunted Janissaries were hauled off in chains. The Mamluks hung crosses around their prisoners' necks as an insult and marched them around their domains to show them off. The son-in-law was forced to kiss the feet of Kait Bey's throne in Cairo. The bigger problem than this defeat was the fundamental instability of this whole region, the crescent of mountainous, difficult territory stretching from the Mediterranean coast of southwestern Turkey through Syria and northern Iraq and then into eastern Iran. It was controlled by a variety of petty Turkoman beys with a propensity for self-preservation. When Ottoman armies rolled through, they were Bayezid's loyal servants. But when the Mamluks were ascendant, their loyalties shifted right back. This was a frontier zone within a frontier zone. Both the Mamluks and the Ottomans struggled to establish more than nominal control, pouring huge amounts of money and resources into sieges and battles and proxy wars with the Turkoman beys for years on end. Bayezid reformed his army and formulated grand plans for direct Ottoman control over the entire region, including Syria, but all to no avail. His army suffered a crushing defeat in 1488, leaving thousands of troops dead on the battlefield in southeastern Turkey, essentially ending any Ottoman hope of outright victory. But all was not well on the other side. Kait Bey had to beg the merchants of Egypt for enough silver dinars to pay his mutinous troops, and resorted to extortion and forced loans to foot the increasingly expensive bills. "The army was unwilling to leave Egypt unless I first paid them," Kait Bey said in December of 1490. "There is no money left in the treasury." Maybe if Bayezid had led his whole army himself, he might have prevailed. Maybe if he could have finangled custody of Chem from his European hiding place, Kait Bey might have been able to spark a rebellion in Ottoman territory and emerge victorious. But Bayezid couldn't head to the frontier for fear of Chem reappearing in Istanbul and launching a rebellion. Kait Bey could never pull enough diplomatic strings to regain control of the Ottoman prince. The end result was a seesawing, costly, inconclusive stalemate. By 1490, after 5 years of war, both sides were ready for peace. The Mamluks were winning the war, but at the cost of economic collapse and internal dissension. The Ottomans could afford to keep fighting, grinding the Mamluks into fiscal ruin through attrition, but by then Bayezid had other concerns. The extremely capable king of Hungary, Matthias Corvinus, was dead, leaving the Danube frontier open. And new opportunities were rising in the west, where the Catholic monarchs of Spain's long war against Granada was reaching its climax. Bayezid dispatched a squadron of warships to raid the Spanish coast, positioning himself as the true defender of Islam, and thus getting one over on Kait Bey and the Mamluks without firing a shot at them. In reality, this was the last gasp of the Mamluks, the final efflorescence of military glory in a run of success that had lasted 250 years. They had won this clash, but their long-term outlook was bad and getting worse.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If we want to understand why the Ottoman-Mamluk conflict was essentially inevitable by the end of the 15th century, we need to grasp a few things about the broader political history of the Islamic world. Now, this is just an overview of a topic that we could spend months or years on, but here's a brief outline. From the very beginning of Islamic history, starting with the Prophet Muhammad, religious and political leadership were closely intertwined. The ideal was that one person could fulfill this intertwined role, combining control over peoples and territory with ultimate authority over the entire community of Muslims, the Ummah. This form of polity is called a caliphate, led by a caliph, who was supposed to be the successor of Muhammad himself. In its original form, the caliphate established by Muhammad didn't last long. It fractured first over the issue of whether the caliph had to be of Muhammad's clan, the original Sunni-Shia split, within a generation of Muhammad's death. Despite that initial rupture, the Umayyad caliphate brought the unified Muslim world to its greatest extent, stretching from northern Spain to the fringes of China. Their successors, the Abbasid caliphs who ruled after 750, slowly lost piece after piece of this formerly, at least in theory, unified world. While the Abbasids retained theoretical religious authority, their political authority was gone everywhere but their heartland centered around Baghdad. Even there, it was military rulers of Turkic origin who held the real power, and that ended in 1258 with the devastating Mongol sack of the city. While the caliphate as a real, tangible form of political organization over the entire Muslim world was only briefly a reality, the ideal was exceptionally durable. It's key to understanding the dynamics of political legitimacy within the Muslim world, and it retains some power even today. ISIS declared themselves to be the real caliphate a few years ago, though even the hardest-line scholars and jurists didn't give them much credence. So, after the sack of Baghdad in 1258, the Mamluks of Egypt took in the remaining Abbasids, and therefore their claim to religious authority within the Muslim world. This was a source of genuine prestige for the Mamluks, especially when combined with their guardianship over Mecca and Medina, and therefore the Hajj, the pilgrimage required of all Muslims who were capable of making it. This made the Mamluks the most prestigious rulers within the Islamic world, whatever their real shortcomings as the 15th century wore on. The Ottomans were aware of this, naturally, and from the reign of Mehmed the Conqueror on, they tried to undercut Mamluk prestige whenever possible. This wasn't just about great power rivalry. It was about the Ottomans increasingly staking a claim on a preeminent position within the broader Muslim world. This was a major step up for an upstart frontier emirate on the fringes of the traditional core of that world, the crescent stretching from Egypt to Syria to Mesopotamia to Iran. When the First War came to an end with a satisfying treaty in 1491, both sides had other priorities to attend to. The Ottomans and the Mamluks managed to stay at peace for a full 25 years, for reasons we'll explore shortly. Bayezid, as I mentioned, turned his attention back to the West. The fall of Granada to the Catholic monarchs in 1492 sparked a renewed interest in holy war, and migrants, both Jewish and Muslim, poured into Ottoman territory. Conversely, the Ottomans faced a renewed threat of crusade from the West. Ferdinand and Isabella were making noises about expanding their war to the coast of North Africa. More seriously, the French King Charles VIII launched a massive invasion of Italy in 1494. This launched the Italian Wars and set off a new age of European power politics and great power rivalries between France, Spain, Venice, and the Holy Roman Empire that lasted for the next 65 years. But it's easy to forget that Charles VIII's original intention was to use his dynastic claim to seize Naples and then use it as a base for a crusade to the east, targeted at the Ottomans. This was a very real motivation for Charles in 1494, part of the general feeling of apocalyptic religious confrontation widespread at the time, even if the dynastic concerns seem more salient in hindsight. Bayezid certainly took this threat very seriously, even more so because Charles took possession of his brother Cem on his way south through Rome. So not only was the most powerful monarch in Europe set on establishing himself a hop, skip, and a jump from Ottoman territory on the other side of the Adriatic with a cutting-edge army, he also had a claimant to the Ottoman throne with him. Luckily for Bayezid, Cem met an untimely end soon after Charles and his impressive army arrived in Naples. Maybe it was poison, maybe it was pneumonia. Either way, Bayezid suddenly had a great deal more freedom to make war on Christian Europe than he had before, now that he no longer had to worry about the possibility of his brother raising a rebellion. The targets Bayezid chose belonged to Venice. For years, Bayezid had been contemplating finishing the job his father had started during his 16-year conflict with the Maritime Republic. The Sultan devoted tremendous resources to building up a considerable fleet, recruiting experienced corsairs, pirates skilled in naval warfare, and paying Venetian renegades to design and build ships. By 1499, Bayezid was ready, launching a full-scale attack on the Venetian possessions left in the eastern Mediterranean. The Venetians clawed back a bit of territory and struck Ottoman possessions in the Aegean with the help of French, Spanish, and papal soldiers and ships. But, in the end, they were forced to cede the key ports of Modin and Koren, both of them vital to Venetian trade with the east, along with Durrës in Albania. The Ottomans reigned supreme in the eastern Mediterranean, and their fleet had become a force even for the mighty Venetian navy to reckon with. Perhaps Bayezid intended to do more further to the west. He was certainly interested in expanding into the Mediterranean, he sponsored corsairs and naval expeditions, and he kept a close watch on the affairs of the Christian powers. But by 1500, even during the war with Venice, other matters to the east became more important. The key process was the rising power of the Safavid order, an order of Sufi mystics with increasingly incendiary beliefs, what contemporary Muslims called gulat, or extremist. More importantly, the Safavids also had expansive political ambitions and dangerously high numbers of followers right on the eastern borders of the Ottoman Empire. We'll talk a lot more about the Safavids in particular and Iran more generally next week. But for now, suffice to say that the rise of the Safavids was exceptionally dangerous for Bayezid and his empire. Dealing with that threat was the top priority for Bayezid. For the time being, the Safavid threat also aligned the interests of the Mamluks and the Ottomans. Remember, the Mamluks too were incredibly exposed in this frontier zone, a mountainous region inhabited by uncontrollable Turkmen who could be mobilized by a charismatic religious extremist. After Kayit Bey's death, his son Mansur married a daughter of Bayezid's in 1498. Bayezid sent an envoy to discuss cooperating against the Safavids in 1502. When a rebellious son of Bayezid's, Korkut, fled to the Mamluks as his uncle Cem had done, the Mamluks eventually returned him to Bayezid. Bayezid even sent men and materials to help the Mamluks fight the newly arrived Portuguese in the Indian Ocean in 1511. What Bayezid didn't want to do was make open war on the Safavids, at least if it could be avoided. This was a major part of what pulled the aging Sultan, he turned 64 years old in 1511, the year he sent aid to the Mamluks in the Indian Ocean, into a conflict with his sons. It was clear Bayezid wouldn't last forever, and as per Ottoman tradition, his sons knew they were going to have to fight it out for the succession. Why wait until the old Sultan was gone to get a head start? Bayezid had three sons. Ahmet, the eldest, seems to have been the one Bayezid favored, though Ahmet reportedly preferred leisure to activity. The Sultan gave Ahmet control of the Anatolian provinces closest to Constantinople, which would give him a leg up on taking control of the capital when Bayezid died. Korkut, the middle son, had no backing. He was deeply pious and loved composing scholarly and theological works, which gave him genuine prestige, but he was an incompetent soldier. Selim, the youngest, was cut from the same cloth as his grandfather Mehmed II. He was aggressive, loved fighting, and had made serious trouble for Bayezid by carrying on an effectively independent war policy against the Safavids in defiance of his father's preference for low-key containment. In 1503, a keen-eyed Venetian observer named Andrea Gritti had this to say about Selim. Quote, "He is considered to be more ferocious and cunning than his brothers, and his eyes betray a cruel streak," Gritti wrote. "He is extremely generous, and at the same time a warmonger. And thanks to these two qualities, he has made great strides." Not for nothing did much later commentators give Selim the epithet the Grim. Selim was increasingly fed up with his father's inactivity, and he wasn't the only one. We'll cover this all in more detail next week in the context of the Safavids, but for now, suffice to say that Selim succeeded in taking the throne in May of 1512. His father Bayezid conveniently died soon after. Now safe on the throne, Selim had big plans for his Ottoman Empire. First among those was dealing decisively with the Safavids, which he did in 1514. Next up were the Mamluks. From Selim's perspective, the Mamluks had gotten too cozy with the Safavids for his liking. Whether the Mamluks had actually concluded an anti-Ottoman alliance with the Safavids is questionable, but Selim certainly claimed that this was the case. Either way, the charge that they were colluding with extremist, Gulat heretics, was a necessary justification for attacking a fellow Muslim sultanate, particularly the one that was the guardian of the holy cities. In 1516, Selim made his move, leading a large, powerful army south into Mamluk territory in Syria. About a day's journey north of Aleppo, on a hot, dusty day in August, his forces met those of the Mamluk Sultan Kansu al-Ghawri in battle. The result was a disastrous defeat for the Mamluks. Kansu al-Ghawri died in the fighting, and the Mamluks were effectively done. Syria fell. Selim continued south to Egypt, winning one final battle against the Mamluks outside Cairo in January of 1517. The Mamluks were finished after nearly three centuries of rule, and the Ottomans reigned supreme from the Nile to the Tigris and the Euphrates to the Danube. They had become an Asian empire, not just a European one, at a stroke effectively doubling their empire's size, population, and wealth. Just as important, the Ottomans had displaced the Mamluks as the protectors of Mecca and Medina. When Selim took Cairo, he deposed the last Abbasid figurehead. But that was a far less important step than declaring himself guardian and protector of Mecca. This was a source of great symbolic prestige, an implicit claim to leadership of the Ummah, the community of believers. But it was also a statement of raw power. To be the protector of the pilgrimage meant wielding real force in this world to safeguard the pilgrimage routes. Selim was presenting himself as a divinely ordained ruler with the worldly power to serve as the guardian of Muslims everywhere. In image and reality, the Ottomans had become the preeminent world power in this stretch of Eurasia. Next time on Tides, we'll explore another facet of the increasing Ottoman attention to and presence in the East, their conflicts with the Safavids of Iran and their wunderkind ruler, Shah Ismail. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.